Ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome to the Solari Report an extraordinary scholar and investor, Dr. Gary Eldred, whose knowledge I did a search looking for the very best person to advise on successful home buying, and I said to our team, you know, this guy is clearly the best, but we probably won't get him, but let's try. So we're very pleased to have him. He is the author of many books on real estate, including Investing in Real Estate, Beginner's Guide to Investing in Real Estate, with the Trump University Real Estate 101, and Flippers, Fixers, and Renovations, Mortgage Secrets, All Borrowers Must Learn. This is somebody who's got very deep knowledge, but my favorite of his books, and the reason I really wanted to get him on today, is one called The 106 Common Mistakes Home Buyers Make and How to Avoid Them. He has been a teacher and a professor. He was on the graduate business faculty at Stanford, taught at University of Virginia, and at one point sent out his students to collect up from all sorts of different real estate players all the worst mistakes they'd seen. And the lovely thing about the book and the format is I can read a lot of books that tell me about the mistakes to avoid and what I ought to do, but this, with the different stories and examples, really brings it home, and you feel the risk, and it makes it personal. And especially if you're doing this for the first time, I think it really helps you get a feel for what's important and how to take care of it. So with that, Dr. Eldred, I can't thank you enough for joining us from your second home in Florida for the Solari Report.
Well, I can't thank you enough for that introduction. That was quite nice. Thank you.
Well, I would say, and I certainly get this feeling from reading the books, that the most important investment someone has to make, particularly for the first time they're buying a home, is they really need to make an investment in their education, because this is, this is a lot of sort of family resources. And it's also a home and a place you're going to be living with. So this affects all aspects of your life. So think of this as one of your major consumption goods and one of your major investments. So I would say number one is investing in your education. So as a academic and a PhD, clearly I'm hoping you'll agree with that.
Yes, I do. And when we look back and we hear so many people saying, well, nobody could have predicted the downturn in prices. And I always like to think that if people had read my book, they would have avoided buying in some of these outrageous markets. Caught up in the almost hysteria of buying and did not educate themselves. And as an academic, as you point out, I definitely favor reading books and talking with people, and also knowing who to trust and who to deal with, trust in terms of their knowledge, because so many real estate agents, appraisers, mortgage lenders, knowingly or unknowingly can mislead you. And I don't mean that in a crooked sense.
Right.
I just mean they have their own biases, and they often will speak and offer you advice in terms of what they think, but not really listen into what you want. And so educating yourself to ask the right questions and probe becomes quite important.
We have a wonderful young producer on a staff, and my understanding from him, he's been researching buying a home. My understanding is that now a lot of the housing agencies and different governmental entities, state and local entities, are offering courses that help new home buyers or home buyers really get educated. Are there any of those courses that you would recommend?
Well, I recommend about anything that someone can do. I think they can learn from it as long as they go in with an open mind and not think about what someone is saying as the gospel, but rather as, oh, here's an idea to consider. Let me think about other viewpoints, or let me think how this might complement or contradict other things that I have learned. So it's a piecing together and not taking from any one person, except me, of course. But no,
right.
So I think it is. Now, many of these courses, though, are taught by people who have either narrow experience. They might be 20 years of experience, but it might be narrow in a particular kind of neighborhood, a particular city, or they might be an expert in one particular type of financing. And even when I read books, I find that the on-home buying of others, as I read nearly everything that comes up, I find how narrow many writers are in their prescriptive advice. But without knowledge of markets, I happen to have lived around the country and in other foreign countries too, and tried to bring a little broader perspective. So make sure you are comparing and contrasting different areas, different kinds of loan products, different kinds of advice.
Right. That really comes out in your book, The 106 Common Mistakes. You really get a sense that the person writing this has dealt with a very wide sample of different places and different circumstances. So it really comes out, and that is unusual, because most people who are really good at real estate, you know, have a niche, have come up through a niche, and you have a much broader spectrum. Yeah. Well, I think what we're saying is you're responsible. You're the one who's going to live in this home. You're the one whose money's on the line. So you have got to get intellectual mastery of what you're doing and why you're doing it. So what about setting goals? I'm a great believer that you can't find what you want unless you can paint a real clear picture of what you want. And so talk to us a little bit about how to go about setting your goals.
Well, one of the things in setting goals, first of all, is to think about what goals are. I've erred in this way myself, sometimes get focused on one particular idea. Maybe it might be location, or it might be price, or size. But to remember, when you're buying a home, there are really multiple goals and multiple objectives, desires that you have. And don't overlook, you'll see lots of advice saying don't buy the most expensive home in the neighborhood, or always buy in a good school district, or and then things like that. These general advice don't work in the sense that there's always trade-offs involved. Sometimes I bought the highest price in the neighborhood, but it happened to have offered tremendous value. Or other times I think now the ratio, the demographics are that fewer than 50% of people have children in grades 1 through high school. And so many neighborhoods that would not have appealed to families with children are seeing a lot of gentrification and younger people moving in, singles, or maybe even retired people. So don't get hung up. I don't like that word, but don't become obsessed with one particular objective or one particular goal as so many people, but think about your other items. And I would say, in terms of my advice, to think both between personal and investment.
Right.
For many people, their first home may not be their last home, and we've now coined the term a starter home. And so in that instance, perhaps building equity counts for more than the most desirable location or the most desirable school district or the closest to shopping and so looking for the foreclosures and REOs that in some markets are still quite plentiful. I know here in Florida there's still quite a few depressed markets that are turning around, but nowhere near the price levels they were in 2006, 2007. Buying that fixer-upper, oh, no, I don't want a fixer-upper. But yes, if you can add $25,000 or $50,000 of money to that and build instant equity, maybe that's worth the effort. So in reading different books, just kind of think of multiple criteria and then choose once you have a panorama of criteria and objectives in front of you, and don't jump without education to a particular goal or objective.
Right. One of the things, and this is a drum I beat not just in real estate, but in all aspects of investing and all aspects of your life, is In this process, you're going to deal with a lot of different professionals. You may deal with brokers. You may deal with other homeowners. You may deal with appraisers, inspectors, attorneys at closing, people from the bank, the mortgage lender. And to me, one of the most important things you can do is find very high quality professionals to help you. So you want people who are both competent and excellent in every way and have an incentive to help you find what you want as opposed to lay off the inventory they want. So say a little bit about how to find the really excellent professionals.
I think the only way or the most important way to work with people whom you can trust in terms of both their integrity and their knowledge is knowing yourself. I know in my own dealings with attorneys in the past, many years ago, you know, I erred, and we were brought up with the idea, well, always trust your lawyer, always follow your lawyer's advice. And I did that, and I found that that was one of the stupidest things to ever do. And now, whenever I'm dealing with lawyers, I make sure I read the cases. I make sure I read the statutes. And I'm just using the lawyer example, their favorite person to castigate, I guess. But there's no substitute for your own education. And
right.
You cannot simply, get someone who's very good and then ask them for advice, because they still may not understand your perspective or what you're really looking for. And also, they may not know the specific issues that are of concern to you. And I had one real estate agent buying properties during the downturn here in Florida, which is why I'm here now to deal with some of these issues. And this agent was very good, but she still could not understand certain things that I was looking for because she had her own biases. So, is she knowledgeable? Is she honest? Yes, but she still had her own mindset of what she thought was great. And it was great for some people, but it wasn't what I was looking for. So you have to have the compatibility that, what is this? I know there's a good French word for this, but, synergism, working together, I suspect.
Well, the other thing is you're signing some very complicated documents and the power of the law is behind them. And that means you have to read them. So whether it's the lending application, whether it's the closing documents, whether it's the appraisal, whether it's the inspection, you really need to, you know, to read it and understand it. And you need to ask people, if you don't understand it, you need to ask questions and you need to get those questions answered.
I think you bring up a very good point there, because I've written a book on mortgages too, or this home buying book or others. They really give you the questions to ask and the issues to consider. And you hear so much advice and read it in the newspapers and magazine articles. Make sure you ask lots of questions. Yes, but what questions do I ask? You know, the general person doesn't know the questions to ask. And that was my mistake in the early years of dealing with law. I didn't know. Okay, so I know some questions to ask, but I don't know from an informed and intelligent perspective what questions to ask. And that's where reading and learning comes about. It and what you will often find too, that tells you whether the person has really the knowledge. When you start asking detailed questions, like you're getting a mortgage and you ask, well, what index, you know, you're debating an adjustable rate mortgage or a fixed rate mortgage, the lender says, well, you know, I'm favoring an adjustable rate. No. I say, well, okay, what index are you looking at? And what's the volatility of those indexes? What? You know, they probably don't even know what index it's tied to and what the volatility of that index has been over the years. Or what's the caps on that? You know, lifetime cap or annual cap. And so you have to know about adjustable mortgages. You just can't even say, oh, an adjustable is better than a fixed, a fixed is better than an adjustable. There's a plethora of questions that go in there that only the education person is going to understand enough to ask about.
Right. I think on everything that you don't know, you need to ask the question, what could go wrong with blank?
Well, certainly a lot of those people that signed those teaser rate mortgages and loan products in the earlier years did not ask the right questions, and they didn't listen to their intuition about, you know, no free lunch. Oh yeah, this is great. But contracts, the same thing. Oh, like not just how much of a deposit, but you know, how long do I have for inspections? Do I get my deposit back?
Right.
You know, what happens if there's a title issue? So
right.
Yeah.
The I have to tell you a story. It's housing related. It's not a home buying story, but it'll give you a sense. I was in a Bible class, and my teacher was very extraordinary. She was a paralegal in a Washington law firm, and she came up after to the class one day, and she said, "You're a financial person," and I said, "Yes." And she said, "Could you help me?" And it turned out she was an extraordinarily sort of fierce and powerful woman. So I was surprised by this. She had a 401k at her law firm, and it was her only savings other than her home. And she wanted to invest in a fund. It was Ginnie Mae Securities financing FHA secured mortgages. And, but she didn't want to put the money in unless she could understand it. And she said, you know, I've tried to talk to the people in charge of the plan, but they're really mean to me and I feel stupid. So could you look at this? And I said, oh, well, you know, I used to be the FHA commissioner, so I'm sure I could understand this. So, well, she read the thing. And Gary, I couldn't understand a word of it. So I said to her, you know, Lisa, I'm real sorry, but I'm having trouble. Could I talk to the people who answer the questions on the plan? And so we got on a conference call and we called the woman, and she was just really mean to me. And finally I said, look, I said, I don't mean to be rude, but I used to be a partner in a major Wall Street law firm, and I was Assistant Secretary of Housing. I was I ran the Federal Housing Commissioner. And, you know, there are people who say I'm really smart about money, but I got to tell you, I don't understand a word of this. So if I can't understand it, how can anybody else understand it? Well, she broke down and admitted the reason she was being so mean is she didn't understand it.
Oh, no.
So we ended up calling the firm that, you know, originated the offering and got our questions answered and figured it out. But what it reminded me, I now live in the South, and in the South, it's really easy to be stupid, to say, look, I just don't understand this. Could you explain it to me? Whereas, you know, I used to live in the North, and then everybody would look at you like you were stupid, and, you know, you'd get that meanness. And I think to me, part of what is really important, particularly for young people, is they realize, look, you're responsible. This is a big decision. This is your money. This is where you're going to live. You know, you've got to ask the questions and you've got to hold people responsible to answer them. And, you know, be stupid. Be stupid. It pays to be stupid.
Yeah.
Okay, so this next one is a big issue for me, and that is finding the right neighborhood. And one of the things I loved about the 106 Common Mistakes is you really describe some of the issues with making sure you're in a neighborhood that makes sense for a variety of reasons. So maybe if you could go into that.
Well, just remembering that the neighborhood itself, like the term location, is a multidimensional. And, you know, we divide it into accessibility and environment and investment quality. So you're weighing off, you know, you might have a great neighborhood with environment. What I mean environmental, I mean, you know, the aesthetics of the neighborhood, or the accessibility, how close to work, how close to shopping, the gym, the parks, whatever. And then the investment idea is, you know, what's the likely appreciation in this neighborhood over the next 5 years? Does it look like it's an up-and-comer, or is it being populated with higher-income people than currently live here, or does it seem to be moving down? So I would say there's three major components to start with, is the accessibility, and each of those can be subdivided into further. And again, it's rarely you're going to find one neighborhood that meets all those criteria. If you do, let me know, especially if it also meets the price criteria.
Well, one of the things you pointed out is you could have some of the good neighborhoods going down in value with some of the gentrifying neighborhoods coming up, and so it's, You know, it's
good point. And that often people say, oh, that neighborhood's been appreciating in the past and that neighborhood's not. Well, it may be in the past, but if that neighborhood now has become so expensive, look around for where people are now starting to buy into because they can't. Because you remember, you say you used to work in Wall Street. You may remember, depending on how old you are, the old days when nobody wanted to live in Brooklyn, who was at all an up and comer. But certainly now there are many, many hot spots in Brooklyn. And Manhattan became too expensive, and then people started redeveloping Brooklyn neighborhoods, and now
there's
quite a desirable number, and it's tough to get into some of them for less than $1 million.
Right. One of the things you do a good job is explaining the the importance of rules and regulations. A neighborhood can be in a jurisdiction that has rules and regulations that make it difficult, and you can be in a homeowners association or other. You know, there's all sorts of complex rules and regulations which can make a place desirable for you or very highly undesirable.
Yes. The rules and regulations, the homeowner restrictions, the deed restrictions, and sometimes even just city laws and city ordinances can all affect things that you may not think would even be covered are covered. Whether you can operate a home business out of it, whether you can whether you can have renters in here. In Gainesville, Florida, where I am right now, if you own a rental property, rental house, the law changed and you cannot rent to more than 3 unrelated adults in bad single-family residential neighborhoods, which is something that would disturb an investor who wanted to put 4 or 5 students into a house, as some do. But there's many rules and regulations, and again, that's where education comes in, because once you redo them, I never thought of that. Oh, I never thought of that. And then you see, now you do think about it.
Well, the other thing that I had never thought about, I thought I'd thought of everyone, was, of course, I'm very focused on, who do I live next to? Who do I want to? Do I want these people to be my neighbors? And when you're looking for a home, that's always a tricky business. If you don't have personal friends or connections or network into a particular neighborhood. But one of the stories you told was of a woman who bought during the winter months, and then the summer comes around and, oh, the noisy children.
Yes, that's right. I remember her. She was one of my graduate students. And she told that story, and it was very good, and it illustrates a great point to look at your property in different times of day. Now, I'll give you an example of a property that I own that I never knew about at the time. Is that I knew it was located next to the high school, but not right next to it. But what I didn't know was in the fall there's band practice, and that Fortunately, I have very good soundproof windows, but, for others less endowed, the band is, holy cow, they're beating us. And you can hear that thing 6 to 12 blocks away. And I think in the book, too, I talk about buying near the stables or buying on
some downwind from the stables.
Downwind from the stables. Or a street that looks quiet on Saturday or Sunday when you're looking at properties, but during the week becomes a major traffic artery for people going back to, university or business or whatever. So looking at a property at different time periods, and talking with people, and make sure you read the disclosure statement. In fact, there's something I would argue many states and cities use, and real estate boards use various types of seller disclosures. In fact, they're the law in most states. But these disclosure statements differ enormously in the types of questions that ask, what happens if the seller misrepresents. And so I would go online and just say, and Google seller disclosure statements, and you will find quite a few different varieties and read through them. And those are great for reminding you of certain questions to ask. And
that's a great idea.
Pay close attention to the answers that the person gives. And almost all of them, unfortunately, in one respect, unfortunately, from the buyer's standpoint, they are not representations. To the best of your knowledge. So, if it, a lot of times sellers can bypass the truth, claiming no knowledge, but
right.
In that instance, what you need is to move forward and actually get signed representations. But there are no noise in the neighborhood or no smells coming through or something like that.
Right.
And a representation is something stronger than a mere disclosure.
Best of, yeah. But it does, I mean, I think it pays when you look at a property to think about it at different times of the week, different times of day, and different seasons of the year.
Yes.
And if you can find people in that area or neighbors and sort of canvass them and learn about, you know, because I'm not one to look at a home, you know, all different seasons before I buy it. That's
right.
Tough.
Of course not. That'd be gone by the time the next season.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay, so figuring out the best home for you.
May I add one point here? This
oh, please.
This is particularly important when you're moving from one climate to another climate, because different features end up of lesser or more importance. For example, you live in the north, a below-grade house with a steep driveway. If you're coming up from Florida, you're not immediately probably thinking snow and ice. But if you're from the north, you're going to think, how am I going to get up that during the snow and ice period? Or
right.
If you're in Florida where there's torrential rains quite often and you're below grade, are these rainwaters going to flood into the garage and the first floor of the house? Or so, you know, the kinds of roofs that are work in different areas, the kinds of construction techniques, each area to a certain degree interrelates with the climate, and that's why asking local people for issues to consider becomes important.
You know, I'm beginning to wonder if anybody's ever made an app with all the different criteria in every step along the way.
You know,
that would be a monster app.
I don't want to scare people away, though, too. Sometimes I feel like although I am an intellectual in a sense that I'm an academic and then a professor, I often over-intellectualize problems, too, you know. And sometimes you just got to go out and do it, you know.
As
much as you can, but, you know, hey, okay, we all make mistakes from time to time, and we learn from them and move on. And, so don't get so much fear and so much analytical that intuition can work well, too, for you.
Right. Well, but your book does a great job of saying, you know, I feel you do a great job of sort of encouraging people with animal spirits, even though you give them the complexity. Because what you point out, one of my favorite sections is, you know, if you rent, you can own. And you come up with a great list of all the different ways, you know, the brokers say, oh, well, you can't, you know, you don't have the down payment, you can't own a home.
Yeah.
And you come up with all the lists of, oh, yes, you can. And here's how.
Yeah.
So I think you do a great job of, go ahead.
I appreciate you saying that because, like I have a friend, a younger friend in Vancouver, Canada, as you probably know, Vancouver prices are just by almost any U.S. standard completely outrageous. But she only earns about $100,000 a year. She bought $1 million house.
Wow.
You buy $1 million house, well, very easy. You take in roommates. You rent out the downstairs to somebody else.
Right.
So now she covers all of her mortgage payments except for about $600 a month on that $1 million house with various ways that she has generated income from it. Now, that won't be a long-term solution, but it helped to get in. And yet so many other people of the same income are saying, I can't afford to buy, But, you know, she did it. And so,
right, and she'll be raising her rents and get her mortgage paid off, and someday she'll be able to live there, you know, just paying the property taxes.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the things you do a great job of pointing out, which is, you know, if owning is the same price as renting now, your rent's going to keep going up. If you buy the house, you lock in now. So
we in the U.S., and I'm not certain of any other country that offers a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. In Canada, most you can get is a 10, and most people get a 5. And then in many other areas of the world, the mortgage terms that are available are far, far deficient compared to ours. Whereas you can lock in that payment today for the next 30 years, but not only that, we get the option of refinancing if rates go down, but not suffering an increase if they go up. I mean, that is a great, of course, it can.
Can they possibly go down anymore?
I don't know. From then on, they're going to be paying us to take out a mortgage. I don't know.
I know. But I know.
I've been saying this, and others with experience of 12 and 16% interest rate that we saw in the early 80s. We're just amazed at these kinds of rates. And 10-year treasuries at 2.2% and 10-year notes in Germany at below 1. I mean,
I know it's remarkable.
It is a wonderful opportunity to get out there and take some long-term financing at these rates.
Right. So let's talk about the best home for you. How do I figure out what's the ideal home for me to buy? Forget investment for a second. Just the home where I'm going to live, the home that I'm going to enjoy. How do I figure out what's best for me?
Now, there's where I think just the feel of the house seems the best. You know, some houses I walked into that just feel right, and others just don't feel right. So I said that feeling. Does it feel comfortable? Does it give you the sense of warmth that you're looking for? Does it give you the views? This is a serene environment. Now, you can see my bias coming through here, but that's what I think. It's really we will deal with the economics one side, but the main thing in the home emotionally, unless you are buying strictly for the investment, but you said ignore the investment part right now. It's really how you're going to feel in that home, and I do like views. I like a warmth. I love hardwood floors. And so I would, what is your emotional quotient and what makes you feel warm and fuzzy? And that's the kind of house to look for. At least that's an important dimension of it.
Right. I have one friend who loves doing fixer-upsers. She can fix anything. She's great with a power saw. And, so for some people, it's, can you make it the way you want? Others, I have a couple of biases, so I'll just be honest about mine. I think a lot of the increase in value in home prices has been inflation and houses getting bigger. That's a lot of the federal credit has encouraged bigger and bigger homes. And one of the things I'm seeing in my sort of world is this move to smaller homes and a tinier footprint, but homes that are much smarter. They're much and more energy efficient. So I'm seeing a shift away from size to something that's much more intelligent. So, I'm curious to know what you think of the tiny home sort of trend right now.
Well, I'm not so much enthused about the tiny homes if we're talking about those under 200 or 300 square feet. But the little house or the smaller house, I definitely think is a trend to the future. Or buying the larger house that you can separate out part of it and
rent
it out. But
I agree.
Think of her last name, Susan Suss. Susan, but she's written a number of books on the small house, although her houses are quite expensive, small houses. But what is her last name? I could probably look on my bookshelf and see it. But that certainly is a trend. And building more into the house, multifunctional areas, getting rid of rooms that nobody ever uses and making up rooms multifunctional. Yeah.
How big were the Sears houses? Do you know?
My guess is they were 800 to 1,000 square feet.
That's what I think. My perfect house is a Frank Lloyd Wright 1,200 square foot. Anyway, I love the ones he did as well. Okay, so let's talk about appraisal and financing. A lot of times, sometimes a home will have an appraisal on it or a near current appraisal, and oftentimes you have to arrange for an appraisal. Talk to us a little bit about how to go through the appraisal and the financing process.
Well, appraisers have, from the buyer standpoint, appraisal has two functions. One, it's to come in high enough that you get your loan, but it's also to come in honest enough that if your contract price is too high, that the appraiser is going to have enough guts to say this house is too much. Now, most of the time they don't, because lenders and loan officers earn their keep by making loans, not by turning
right.
people down. And so you must beware of appraisals that come in right at the contract price. Now, various federal laws and regulations have interceded here to presumably make this an arm's length type of thing, but it does not work that way. And in fact, appraisers don't want to mess up deals. And they will only do so if they really feel safe in doing so or really feel that the buyer wants them to do so. So never, the bottom line here is never count on an appraisal. The appraisal will come in and so it must be worth. No. And also, the appraisal is a today's price based upon today's market. And what you really want to know is what the future price. So the appraisal is not
right.
going to give you, and that's, you know, that can work to your advantage. If you are in an area that's going to depreciate, but it can work to your disadvantage, as many people learn when they paid way too much for future price during 2006-2007. The other part to verify is always look at the comparable. An appraisal of a residential single-family house or a condominium will use two or three or four, maybe as many as six other houses. It is critically important to go through and see the addresses of those houses and go by and look at them. Appraisers will take comparables. One, they may just look for something that supports the value, and it really doesn't. It's on the wrong side of the street. It's got an old, it's older. I do this just for fun. It's go out and look at comparables that the appraisers have selected. And so often these comparables are not comparable at all. And
right.
So that's the most important. One of the most important.
Is there any way you can get the comparable information before you make a bid on a house? Can your broker get you the comps?
Oh, sure. Of course. In fact, in today's world, you know, anybody can get any of the comps they want through Zillow or however
right.
one pronounces that, and Trulia and realtors. And yes. In fact, the appraiser is almost a useless occupation these days, given the wide availability of information on the internet. And you can do in Florida, and I think in most states, you can go onto the county assessor's website.
Right.
And pull
right. More and more of the assessors are online. Yeah.
Yes. And so today, no one needs to depend on an appraisal to find out what comparables are selling.
I just have to tell you, though, we have an appraiser in my county who's been, you know, who's sort of the top guy for decades. And he is such a wealth of information. I love it every time I get the house appraised because I get quite an education, but he's special. So hopefully
yeah.
you can find a good one.
I think more today is the loan officer. If you're getting a loan, the loan officer will delegate to what they have our appraisal hiring agent,
right.
sort of a middle person who then selects the appraiser, presumably making an arm's length from that. So I don't think the buyer actually has much choice in it. But, of course, you can always hire your own. And the person, there's no reason an appraiser couldn't give you great information.
I live in a remote section of Hickory Valley, so every lender is going to go to this guy.
Oh, Oh.
He's the top dog. Financing. How do we find the right lender? And I've got a lot of feelings on this one, because I've found, you know, in my own circumstance, that if I allow the loan to be securitized, I can end up with, you know, a nightmare of servicing, and have to be very, very careful. But I would love to hear your thoughts on how to get a mortgage that ends up with an honest servicer.
Well, that's because you really don't have a choice in the sense,
right,
the loan instrument itself gives the lender the right to sell the servicing rights or sell the loan itself. And then even the person who owns the loan can change who the servicing is going to be. So that would be tough. I don't know quite how to do that. Now, there are some lenders now who are holding their own long-term loans and not securitizing them. I have not experienced much problem with loan servicing companies, but I certainly have read so many horror stories on it, especially during the downturn when banks were going out of business and selling off. And so I don't have, in terms of the interest rate, the closing cost, these generally, unless you're going to a subprime lender or something, if you're dealing with any kind of Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac product, the market's going to be pretty competitive.
Yes.
Hello?
Gary?
Yes.
Can you hear
okay,
me?
I thought I'd lost you.
No.
Okay. Dealing with a lender, or a loan officer, I should say, because you're really dealing with a loan officer, not with Wells Fargo or J.P. Morgan Chase. You're dealing with that particular loan officer, although they'll have standards. And the loan rep is the one who you want to count on to help you assemble your information and put forth the data in a way that will guarantee or almost guarantee your loan approval. And talking with one ahead of time and then finding out, well, what do I need to do to make my credit score higher, or even going to myfico.com and trying to arrange ahead of time so that you...
What's that website, Gary?
Myfico.com.
Ah, there's okay.
That's the credit rating or the credit scoring firm that most lenders use.
Okay.
And then it gives pointers on different methods to increase your credit score. Because in today's world, the market is loosening up a little, mortgage market's loosening up a little bit, but it's still pretty tight. And the higher your credit score, the better you're going to qualify for the lowest interest rate and the best terms.
Now, let's say I've made a bid on a property and I've applied for financing, so the appraisal and financing process is in the works. I get an inspection, and of course my bid is subject to the inspection not bringing up anything that was not known, that was not disclosed. So talk a little bit about how I go about the inspection process.
First, make sure you go with the inspector when the inspector goes through the house, and then you ask, when he starts poking into a little wood rot, ask questions about it. Is that serious? Where's the leak coming from? Does that signal deeper problems that we are likely to exist that we can't see from the surface? So going with the inspector and asking questions on what he discovers, and even looking out for yourself, because the inspectors won't catch everything. And asking the questions. Also, asking not just about the condition of the property, but asking about the maintenance required to keep the property in good condition. Some homes low maintenance, some high maintenance. I think often people buy without the idea of, there's big variance in houses as to the amount of money, time, and effort that is required And so those two issues, go within, find out what's wrong, ask questions, but also find out what's right or what could be creating problems down the road, and how do you maintain the property, and how expensive is it to maintain the property.
Right. I was, and I always encourage people to do not just a money budget, but a time budget. I'll never forget when I used to be on the board of a group called the National Association Multifamily. We had a professor come in from University of Maryland who'd spent his entire career collecting information and data on homeowners versus renters. And what he said, it was an absolutely fascinating presentation. What he said was, essentially, if you owned a home, on average, you spent 20 hours, or a family spent 20 hours a week on things related to taking care of, fixing up, you know, gardening, doing on their home, as opposed to renters. So, and then he said renters spent most of that 20 hours watching television.
I think the point is well taken, but the time estimate that he discovered is quite exaggerated, unless he enjoys doing those things.
Yeah, I think what he was capturing was the fact that people enjoy gardening or fixing things up, or, you know, so part of that is much more, it's not maintenance as we would think of maintenance, it's things that people enjoy doing in their home,
personal,
in and around their home.
And I know my father did, and my parents spent a huge amount of time, but it was for their personal enjoyment. My father's garden and his flowers and doing things to improve it, but making the home feel much more like a home than like a place where I'm going to be moving, so the lease is up.
Right. So, well, how much, in terms of budgeting time, on average, how much do you think somebody should budget for taking care of their home on a weekly or monthly basis?
Well, I'll tell you how much my time budget is.
Okay, that works.
Would you like to guess?
I bet you're unbelievably efficient, so I bet it's on average 2 hours a week.
Yeah, that's about right. Or my philosophy is hire somebody else to do it.
Right.
So
right. No,
that's my philosophy. So I just don't want to do yard care or painting or any of that. You know, of course I wash my dishes. You won't big piles of dishes or clothes or something around. But I would say for the average person, that when you think about shoveling snow and then the condominium is one of the ways to avoid those types if you really don't want
right.
a townhouse where there is the external. My Canada home is a single family, but it is in a what they call bare land strata development. And so all the exterior, not the exterior maintenance on the house, but the exterior, the maintenance of the house is built in such a way that it requires very little maintenance. So it goes back to the low maintenance. You can have low maintenance properties or you can have high maintenance. I mean, when I look at some of these houses on an acre of land with massive yards, I just think work or money. $300 a month for a lawn keeper. Yeah.
I'll tell you an interesting story. When I lived in Washington at one point, I'd never lived in the suburbs, and I thought, you know, I want to try this. I want to see this, but I don't know if I'm going to like it. And I found it was literally an all-glass house that was up on a butte overlooking the river. It was out in McLean. It was very beautiful, but it was extremely unusual. The guy had built one exactly like it in York, Pennsylvania, where he had moved. He loved the house so much. So I said, you know, I just don't know if I want to do this. So I leased it with an option to purchase, which, you know, if you're in a market that's as down as it was, right? It was just 1991, so the market was way down. To me, it's a very clever thing if you can find an owner who's willing to do it. So I locked in an option to purchase. And the first thing that happened, remember, I'd always lived in the city. is there was a wonderful gardener who sort of came with the property. So he had the deal on keeping it up. So the first spring, he said to me, well, you know, the bushes got ratty. You know, and I said, well, just fill them out and, you know, get whatever you need. Well, the bill was $6,000 for bushes. And I said, well, you know, I want to keep it beautiful. You know, I think I may buy this. And then, so the next spring, it was another $6,000. And I said, you know, that's it. I'm moving back to the city.
Well, yeah.
But it was beautiful.
Yeah.
Well,
wow.
So in closing, let's talk about, you know, sort of success. If anybody would know this, you would. Have there ever been any studies that say, am I happier as a renter versus a homeowner? What is the sort of satisfaction quota of being a successful homeowner? Is there any science on that fact?
Well, I would say the biggest science would be just what we witness is that 2/3 of households own their own house. And if there was
right.
a distinct advantage to renting, it would work the other way. So I think the experience of the fact that most people do want to own, and once you become a homeowner, you certainly rarely want to go back to renting. I had a few friends who've done that, but for the most part, people who own want to remain owners. Now, as we are so often reminded at the aging of the population, whether that will remain true, I don't know at some older age, but
right.
I think the just looking around and seeing most people either own or aspire to ownership is the test, which is the best way to follow. For most people, but again,
it's funny when I went on the board of the Multifamily Association, I went into the first meeting and there's a huge number of people were talking about how unsuccessful we've been at lobbying. And so they're going on and on about how unsuccessful they've been and what's their problem. And I said, well, wait a minute. Who here is a renter? And no one raised their hands. And I said, so everybody here who's lobbying the Congress is a homeowner. And I said, what you have to understand is when those Congress critters look at you guys, what they see are homeowners. It was kind of funny.
Yeah.
Well, the last thing I just wanted to touch base on the market. And because I've seen, you know, there's a lot of discussion over the last week because the financial institutions are finally starting to loosen up their terms. You know, the terms were very tight after,
yeah.
And it always happens when the market crashes, everybody tightens up the terms. So finally, it's starting to loosen up. And I would ask what any comments you have on what impact you think that's going to get and how the market is in general and where the opportunities are for people who are looking to buy their first home.
Well, with the fact that the markets are still well below, most markets are still well below where they were in 2007, and interest rates are at 3.75 to 4.25, I suspect, on a 30-year now. Not that I'm recommending a 30-year. If someone can afford a 15, I would urge that too. And the rates there probably are in the 3.5 now.
Yeah, they're lower. I just refinanced to a 10 or 15-year, or I'm in the process of doing it now. I'm just bringing it in as short as I can.
Yeah. With these kinds of interest rates, I cannot emphasize enough that you don't own, get out there and own. With some, you know, obviously personal exceptions that people just don't want or what life stage or whatever. But if someone's anywhere near the fence, now's the time to jump over it because these lending rates and housing prices both being what I think is at a low for the first
time.
That it is a difficult an opportune time. And
it is an opportune time. And I would say this, when I spend a lot of time traveling by car, and I see tremendous dispersion in the strength in different markets. So you have some areas that are, and this gets back to your discussion on neighborhoods, you have some areas where the economy is still very much down, could even go further down. Other areas that are going gangbusters. I'm talking to you from the San Francisco Bay Area, just you know, it's how high can you go?
Yes.
This is not
that
a, this is
an area that has really recovered
these prices are, this is not a housing market. It's a space elevator.
It's wealth driven more than earned income. Of course, it's earned income also. But you mention a very good point, and in helping in looking forward into the future prices is what is the economic base of the area? What is the stability of jobs in the area? And some of those depressed areas are areas where the jobs aren't coming back, and and in other areas where they have either some demographic or economic reason for having population growth and income growth and wealth growth.
Well, Gary, I can't thank you enough for doing this today. It's been really a pleasure to talk to you. You have to just give us 2 more minutes and describe how to find your books. But before you do, I'm going to tell anybody who's thinking of buying a home, they have to buy the 106 Common Mistakes Homebuyers Make and How to Avoid Them, because it really, this is how you get decades of experience without having to personally suffer through it.
Well, thank you. I think you mentioned at the very beginning, they are based upon real life stories. So it's more stories than just the advice giving. Most of the bookstores will carry it or can obtain it, and Barnes & Noble often carries it or can easily obtain it. And, of course, any of the online retailers such as Amazon, it's available. I am someone who really loves my local bookstores and want to do everything I can to support them. Unfortunately, they are disappearing. And
yeah, they are.
That's a very sad cultural, and they're just overall. So I like to support whatever local bookstores are available. But, of course, Amazon's a great blessing, too, for authors, because it does make our books available to everyone in the country or the world.
Yeah, yeah, it does. I used to always buy my books at Bibliophile, which was a used network of sort of you could buy used book, and then Amazon bought it. So there I was back in Amazon. But there's a good selection of the both new and used at Amazon. So it's, and I'm sure you can, if your library doesn't have it, you can have the library. You know, I live in a place where the libraries are very good about ordering something and getting it on the interlibrary loan system. And I'm sure your books are available.
Yes, so, most times.
Are you going to be updating Investing in Real Estate? Are you going to come out with a new edition?
I hope so. We usually do that about every 2 or 3 years, and last one was in 2012, so I'm hoping we can come out with a new edition in next year.
Okay, well, if you do, let me know. I would love to get you back to do Investing in Real Estate. That would be terrific.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay, Gary, you have a wonderful day. Enjoy Florida, And we will let you know when we post the interview. Have a wonderful day.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Okay, bye-bye.